all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web. VeteransRadio.org is our new URL, VeteransRadio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to VeteransRadio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. We're going to hear from two extraordinary Americans talking about, is the United States ready on a national security stance to deal with what's coming? And we're going to look at it both from the Air Force standpoint and from the Navy fleet standpoint. Our first guest has the handle Lucky. Her name is Heather Penny. She'll tell her story about flying. And then we're going to talk to Admiral Green about the Navy fleet. So I think you'll get really informed about what we need to be doing as a country to make sure that our freedoms remain protected both here and around the world as we're in July of 2024 in the shadow of Independence Day. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Heather Penny. She is a senior resident fellow at the Mitchell Institute of Aerospace Studies. We have her on because of her extensive pilot and deep thinking about the Air Force. We've got an interesting topic to talk about. But Heather, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much. I'm so pleased to be here.
Well, let's start at the beginning, because your whole life really has been centered around flying and things related to flying. But how did a nice girl from Reno, Nevada end up with such a passion over aviation?
I'm afraid I came by it honestly. My daddy is a fighter pilot in Vietnam. He flew A-7s as a Sandy. So we did the combat search and rescue mission, picking up downed pilots and air crew in Vietnam. And then when he got out, he continued to serve by flying for the Reno Air National Guard, doing the recce mission in RF4. So I grew up around military aviation, and I just loved the fighters. They were fast, they were mean looking, and they just felt so strong and purposeful. But I also fell in love with the community. The pilots in my dad's squadron, they were full of purpose, the brotherhood, the connection and community they had. And they were focused on excellence and doing their mission well. And plus, when they would tell their stories, it sounded like the greatest adventure story that you could go on. So I was hooked on aviation from a very young age. And of course, being in Reno and my dad racing, I grew up around all kinds of aviation. So it's just something I couldn't get out of my blood.
Well, that's, I've read a lot about you online, but that part of the backstory isn't generally told. So I figured there was a family connection to military aviation, so thanks for telling it. But here's a better story that you're not going to find anywhere else, listeners, and we're talking to Heather Penny. I asked Heather earlier, hey, how did a nice girl like you end up at Purdue University, where you picked up both your bachelor's and your master's degree? And, there's always a story, too, how that happens. How did that happen here?
I can't believe you're making me fess up.
I am. They won't take back your degrees at this point.
No, thank goodness, right? It was the school with the latest application date. I was terrified about the process. I didn't really understand how to navigate college applications, and it was the school with the latest application date. So I am so fortunate they took me in. But I am very much a proud Boilermaker, and I'm happy to say that my youngest daughter is following in my footsteps, not in the aviation realm, but she has been accepted into Purdue. She accepted her admission, and she'll be attending Purdue as a rising freshman this next year.
Oh, that's great. We in the Midwest think highly of Purdue University. It has a great engineering school, and we know a lot of proud alumni from there. But from there, you went on and said, okay, I've got my degrees. Let's get into aviation. Tell us about your time in the service.
Well, I actually, part of the reason why Purdue was on my list was because they had an ROTC department, and I wanted to be a fighter pilot. And when I arrived at on campus and I contacted the RTC, they're like, no, girls can't be fighter pilots, because at the time, in 1992, they couldn't. The combat exclusion for aviation had not been lifted by Congress until later. So that's when I ended up going into the humanities, into the College of Liberal Arts, is where I got my bachelor's and my master's. So I was in the middle of my master's degree studying American studies, which is an interdisciplinary field, when I learned that Congress had indeed removed that exclusion, and I could apply to become a fighter pilot. And so there I went through the Air National Guard route, not the active duty. And the reason why is in the mid-1990s, you know, the Soviet Union had fallen. It was the end of history. The Berlin Wall had crumbled years earlier. And so our nation was trying to reap this peace dividend. They didn't think we were the only superpower on the globe, so why do we need to have a military anymore? And they literally cut our Air Force in half. And so the active duty, their planes cut in half. They were doing a reduction in force, so they were actually forcibly exiting pilots from the service, saying, you know, thank you very much, but next year you're not going to be in the Air Force anymore. Go find a job. And so because I wanted to fly fighters, it was really high risk to go to the active duty. So because my dad had been in the Guard, I knew that if I was hired by the Guard, if they had fighters on their ramp, and if I was good enough, if I was qualified and I passed all the check rides, if I was good enough, I could control my destiny and go fly fighters.
It's important. I want to point out, Heather, it's important, this 1990 experience that you went through about that reduction, because it's going to come back when we talk about the issue on which you're quoted in the Defense News article that caught my attention. But that's why you got yourself into the Guard. And tell us about your time in the Guard, your overseas deployments.
Yes, I was fortunate to be hired by the D.C. Air National Guard, the 121st Fighter Squadron in Washington, D.C., and they fly F-16s. So I went through NJET, which is the Euro-NATO Joint Jet Pilot Training in Texas. My qualifications got me above the threshold to attend this undergraduate pilot training, which is pretty exclusive. If you graduate from there, you're going to get a fighter. It's kind of an all-or-nothing gamble. And then I went through my F-16 training and showed up to my fighter unit and became combat mission ready in early 2001. Well, guess what happens next?
Exactly.
So on 9/11, Mark Sasseville and I were sent in unarmed F-16s on a suicide mission to Flight 93. As you can imagine, this was unprecedented times for our nation, and we are very fortunate that the passengers on Flight 93 are true heroes. I mean, they took their fate into their own hands to protect our nation. But this led to the last couple decades of the long wars in the Middle East. And I've got two combat deployments underneath my belt. One was initial combat operations to Iraqi Freedom, where my unit, at our wing, we were tasked with hunting Scuds. So I was primarily a nighttime Scud hunter. And we went back and then did more 06. And then I transitioned from the fighter. I had to leave it as a single mom with two little girls. I couldn't sustain the deployments. And so I was fortunate to be able to fly the DV airlift mission. And then I retired out of the Pentagon, out of the National Military Command Center. But during that time, I also, as a guardsman and then as a reservist, worked within the defense industry. So I understood the defense industry. And I'm now a senior fellow at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies, which is a think tank that focuses on air power and Air Force issues.
And that's really what got us to this article and me tracking you down to talk about. You mentioned the defense industry, and you had a various positions with Lockheed Martin as the director of different Air Force programs. So you had both the military service, the contractor, defense contractor information experience, and now this think tank experience. And that kind of gets us to this article that I guess I hadn't thought about, and probably many veteran radio listeners have not thought about, and that is the stress both on the fleet and the force that the Air Force has experienced because of these long wars that you mentioned. Set this up for us. Tell us what the looming problem is as you see it.
The looming problem is that our Air Force is, I'm just going to say it, it's in a death spiral. So in the 1990s, we cut the force in half. And like, for example, the fighter force literally cut in half, just divide it by two. So you've got 50% of what you had. And then we go into operations in the Middle East. Well, now you have fewer aircraft, but the demand signal has gone up dramatically. Now, even though we had been doing Operation Northern Watch and Southern Watch, so everyone else got to come home after Desert Storm. The Air Force did not get to. We conducted airspace control operations over Iraq, both the southern side and the northern side, to protect the Kurds and also to prevent a further aggression from Saddam Hussein. So the Air Force never came home. But now suddenly they're doing more with less. And so not only do you measure the age of aircraft in terms of chronological years, but you measure it in terms of flight hours. So we are just flying the hell out of these airplanes, and they are dying sooner than they had been planned. Most of the aircraft that were built in the 1980s, now you remember the Reagan era buildup, he didn't actually grow the Air Force tremendously. What he did was he did a complete turnover of the Air Force. So all of the Century Series fighters and Vietnam type fighters that we had, he recapitalized with the modern fourth generation fighters that we're familiar with seeing, the F-15, the A-10, the F-16. During the 1980s, we were buying these aircraft at 200 to 300 a year. So now they're 20 years old as we go into Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom. And not only are they at least 20 years old, but now suddenly we're flying them much harder than they were ever planned to be. So instead of 4,000 hours, we're now flying these aircraft to 8,000 hours. So you can imagine how sort of long in the tooth and tired they are. As a matter of fact, in I think it was 2015, and you could probably double check the actual year, but an F-15 is flying over St. Louis. It's doing a normal training sortie, and it just breaks in half because it was so, the metal was
yeah, metal fatigued. Stress, yeah, fatigue.
Yeah. It was so fatigued. So even though we can modernize these aircraft with new widgets and new radars and new data links and all that good stuff, the airframes are still old.
And while numbers don't tell you the whole story, the numbers here kind of do give you a little shocking view of this. Is it's predicted that the fleet's going to drop, the Air Force's fleet is going to drop below 5,000 fighters, bombers, tankers, the whole thing in 2025, and it's never been that low, if I understand it.
It's never been as low as it is today, and it's getting even smaller. The Navy has actually bought more fighters than the Air Force has in the last 20 years. And even since we started Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, and we've been continuing these combat operations, the Air Force has continued to get smaller, even though the demand signal is going up.
Somebody in Congress must be looking at this and saying, hey, we're paying attention to how many ships we have in the Navy because of the China situation. Is Congress paying any attention? Is the public paying any attention to what's happening to the Air Force?
I don't think there's as much as attention being paid to this as it should be. Because now, fortunately, we do have some members in Congress that are blocking the Air Force from divesting more aircraft without a plan. But if you think about it, the United States military has operated under a veil of air supremacy since 1954. They haven't had to worry about enemy bombers, enemy fighters, enemy missiles, or things like that since 1954. And so I think they take air power for granted. They just assume that the Air Force is going to continue to be able to completely control the skies. And I wish there had been more of a wake-up call when our base in Iraq was attacked this past year by Iranian ballistic missiles, because that should have had people go, whoa, wait a second. Maybe we need to pay more attention to air control. Because if you think about what's going on in Ukraine, which feels a lot like World War I, right, with the way that the lines are, it's just a battle of attrition and atrocity.
Yep, ground pounding, yep.
Yeah, I mean, that that is primarily because neither side has real air power in the way that we have shaped our joint force to employ. And so it is at the end going to be just a matter of who has bigger numbers of bodies and bullets the way they're fighting Ukraine. And what a horrific way to fight war.
Well, sometimes when we have these discussions, people say, well, we don't need to be as big as we have been or are to maintain, for example, air supremacy, because we have allies, we have friends. That's part of the argument about the Navy, and Australia is going to be there for us, and Japan's going to be there for us. We'll see. But is that the argument that the U.S. Air Force doesn't need to be of its size because you've got NATO or something? What's the explanation for letting the Air Force fleet wither on the vine?
I would say there's three factors. And, one is just simply budgets. The Air Force has not been provided the necessary resources to recapitalize the way that it needs to. Some of this is if you look at the last 20 years, the Army has been the preponderance of forces in the Middle East. And so the Air Force has been funded to, as a comparison, $1.3 trillion less than the Army over the last 20 years. At the same time, that has forced them to cut their recapitalization plans. So where the Air Force is right now is they basically have to recapitalize every single major weapon system they have now, because they have been limping everything along as long as they possibly can. So they have to recapitalize helicopters, strategic deterrence. So this is, they have to recapitalize and replace the Minuteman III, which has been our ground-based nuclear deterrent for the last 70 years, right? They've got to recapitalize bombers. They've got to recapitalize fighters. They've got to recapitalize their specialized, what we call them, HAVAs, the high-value assets, everything from AWACS to JSTARS to rivet joint to all of these other aircraft, all at the same time. So that's a huge bill, because they've been deferring this for so long because of budget pressures, right?
Yeah, that catches up to you, and that's what's happening, right?
And there's two more pieces. One, that's a main causal root cause. But there's also this belief in third offset technologies. That's the buzzword for your listeners. They want to sound insiders, where the more exquisite and the more sophisticated the technology is, the more effective we can be, so we need less stuff. But that only works to a point. And that's, for example, one of the reasons why air power is able to be so dominant in Desert Storm, that the Army was just basically able to walk right up to Baghdad, is because of these advances in technology and how we employed that. But the problem is that twofold. One, technology is no longer the unique domain of the free world and specifically of America. There's a lot of really smart engineers and software coders and technologies out there, right? And two, one thing can only be in one place at one time. It doesn't matter how effective it is. So that's sort of like the Battlestar problem, right? Is that, you have one widget, it might be incredibly effective, but you cannot cover the entire breadth of the Pacific with it. You cannot cover, you cannot feel the force of a small amount of things. So scope and geography is now, and also now that we're facing more, I would actually call them peer threats, right? Where they're China, Russia, and other nations are becoming, they're getting better at what they do. We need to begin to account for attrition as well. So that's really, and so Secretary Kendall right now is embarking and has been divesting older platforms so we can invest in research and development. But the problem is it creates this bathtub where you're getting rid of the aircraft that you have to a very, very small force in the hopes that future technologies will arrive in the 2035 timeframe that will be relevant to that timeframe. So Kendall's trying to transform the Air Force, and I don't disagree with his intent, but what I'm deeply concerned about is this, the next decade of how the Air Force is becoming so small that we will not be able to meet the demands of our national security interests. We won't be there for our joint partners. And how do we grow when we've gotten too small? It's a death spiral.
Yeah, trying to ramp back up every business, every team, every whatever you've ever been in understands the idea of how much more difficult it is to ramp back up after you've gotten that small. And we've moved cyber into a new segment, and we have things. You talk about technology offsets. I think, do people think drones are, you don't need the Air Force of old because you've got drone technology?
Unfortunately, people do. People are of this belief that suddenly now quadcopters are around and there's drones, there's artificial intelligence. We just put these little unmanned, vehicles up there. And we're seeing a lot of that in Ukraine, but people are not seeing how these drones are falling out of the sky there. And so when we look at Ukraine and what's going on in Ukraine and how they're using drone technology there, there are uses for these kinds of drones, but then also the Air Force is looking at what they call collaborative combat aircraft. And these should be smaller, cheaper, autonomous aircraft that are probably modular. They can have different capabilities like jamming or sensing, or they can be missile trucks or things like that. But they should help address the capacity requirement that the Air Force will have in future war. And also they have the interesting opportunity to change the risk calculus. So we did a war game last year at the Mitchell Institute to look at how you might use these collaborative combat aircraft. And what we found was that operators wanted to use them in disruptive and sort of chaotic little ways. They wanted to be able to use these drones to be able to detonate adversary tactics, force the adversary to react, to deplete the adversary magazine, and to get them off their game. So that basically then would put our manned aircraft in a position of advantage. And let me tell you why humans in the battle space, especially in aircraft, will continue to be really important, because we don't even have smart self-driving cars just yet.
Right.
And that's a two-dimensional problem set with well-known and well-accepted rules of the road in an unchanging environment. Fairly unchanging, right? The roads generally stay where the roads are. Going into a high-intensity conflict in three-dimensional airspace is not quite so easy of a problem set. And so having humans being able to make decisions through uncertainty, ambiguity, and improvise within the battle space based off of human mind and imagination and training will continue to be a critical component of our combat edge. as opposed to putting, you know, a drone out there that we'll call it smart, but still is only as smart as it's trained and doesn't have the ability to adapt to deception, doesn't have the ability to adapt to hacking, and could be, depending on the what goes on with the adversary, could be fairly predictable to the enemy.
And I guess we're going to run out of time, and boy, we could have gone a lot longer. But as you cut airframes, you're cutting the workforce.
Yeah, you're cutting pilots. And that's what happened.
And mechanics and everybody in between.
Yep. Yep. Exactly. And it's the people that are our combat edge, our combat advantage. And so in the Air Force, the end strength or the manpower or the number of workers you have is all based off of how many airplanes and how many weapon systems you have. So for example, in my fighter squadron, we had a 2.5-to-1 crew ratio. So we had 2.5 pilots for every single airplane that we had. And that allowed us to fly full flying schedule, give people crew rest, train the appropriate levels. We weren't overmanned. So everyone got the number of training flights and the sorties that they needed. And that also drove the amount of intel officers that we had and how many mechanics we had and how many weapons troops, so the guys that build the bombs and the missiles, how many of those guys we had. So when you cut platforms, when you cut aircraft, you cut the workforce. And you're usually cutting your most experienced people. And experience matters in combat. And we know this from history, whether or not it's in Vietnam or you go back to World War II. For example, Germany had, you know, some of the most experienced fighter pilots at the beginning of the war. And just through statistics and attrition, those guys died out. So by the end of the war, Germany was building and producing more fighters than they did at the beginning of the war. But the kids they put in there were so inexperienced, they just got shot down.
Yeah.
Same reason why Japan had to resort to kamikaze attacks in the end, because they lost their experienced pilots.
Well, we've been talking to Heather Penny, call sign Lucky, who has been helping us understand the challenges that the United States Air Force is facing as its airframes dip below 5,000 in fiscal year 2025, and the risk that that causes to the nation on national security, being able to have the up-tempo that we are often called to have in the Air Force. Heather, this has been a great conversation. We appreciate your work here as Senior Resident Fellow at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies, and you've given us a great insight into this problem, which is something we all should be watching.
Oh, thank you, Jim. It really has been an honor to speak with you. If you don't have an Air Force, you cannot have a Joint Force. Amen. I hope to chat with you again.
I hope you found that informative. Heather Penny is a real patriot. You certainly got that from the interview. But you should also know that on September 11th, 2001, when she was just a first lieutenant at the time, she was ordered to, along with another pilot, take her F-16 fighter and head it to Pennsylvania. They were ordered to down the United Flight 93, which was heading to Washington, D.C. Now, they were up doing training missions, and there was no ammunition. These two F-16s were flying, but they were not outfitted with live ammunition, other than maybe 100 rounds of ball ammunition always carried to maintain trim. So the mission was take down United 93, and if the passengers on United 93 did not crash that into the fields in Pennsylvania, it would have been the job of Heather Penny to do just that, and she was lucky that didn't have to occur, and she's still here to tell the stories, but you can understand how that molded her to her core as a pilot, as a patriot. So, great story, a lot to learn. Stick around, you're going to learn now what the concerns are with the naval fleet and what our opposition is doing versus what we're doing here in building out the fleet.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. Veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We want to welcome back to Veterans Radio today Vice Admiral Kevin Green, United States Navy retired. We're going to talk about the fleet structure and issues related to that, and then we're also going to get into talking about the Navy's recruiting issue and how that impacts all these other decisions. But let me set this up a little bit. Kevin Green went to Annapolis in 1971, and about 30 years later, 30-plus years of military service, retired as a vice admiral, has been very active in all things defense and Navy since then, both in the private government, private corporation world, as well as government affairs, and stays very attuned to things. He commanded the USS Abraham Lincoln carrier group when he was active duty, and I think his last assignment was Deputy Chief of Naval Operations Plans and Policy before his retirement. Admiral, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Jim. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, we spoke before about something that's going on, which is NATO's 75th anniversary, and we got done. And I said, hey, Admiral, I got some more questions for you. And you were gracious enough to say, yeah, we should talk about that. And so really what we want to talk about, it starts with acknowledging some of the challenges that the United States has in its national security around the world on the high seas. And that leads you into thinking about, well, what's the right Navy force structure? What are the plans that we have to have in place? So why don't you recap a little bit about what the Navy looks at in terms of strategic concerns on the oceans around the world?
Certainly. And the foundation of all of that is a description of the missions of the Navy. Why do we have a Navy in the first place? And what does the Navy do for the country? More than 50 years ago, the Chief of Naval Operations, the Senior Admiral of the Navy, laid out four basic missions for the Navy. One of them, strategic deterrence, principally through our strategic submarine force. The next was sea control, maintaining control of the seas, projection of power ashore with our partners, the United States Marine Corps, and the Army, complete, and naval presence around the world. And by missions, what we're talking about are the outputs of the objectives of having a Navy in the first place. Recently, the current Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Franchetti, answered the question publicly when asked, what does the Navy do? And the Navy is here to preserve the peace, to respond in a crisis, and to win decisively in wars. The Navy operates far forward around the world and around the clock, from the seabed to space and cyberspace and in the information environment, promoting our nation's prosperity and security, deterring aggression, and providing options to our nation's leaders. We deliver power for peace and are always postured and ready to fight and win as part of the joint force, that is, with the other U.S. military services and alongside our allies and partners. The headquarters of the Navy is focused on organizing, training, and equipping the Navy in order to carry out the missions that are assigned by the combatant commanders. The geographic combatant commanders run various sections of the globe, and we, along with the other services, provide the forces that allow them to carry out their peacetime and their wartime missions. So what we do is a really important part of that. And when we start thinking hard about the force structure, the size of the fleet, one measure is the total number of battle force ships. Today, there are 293 battle force ships, meaning what you would think of as warships, aircraft carriers, amphibious assault ships, destroyers, cruisers, frigates, littoral combat ships, and so forth. 293 of them altogether. When we also count the military sealift command ships, the ships that provide the logistics support for that battle force.
When you put that in context, give us some indication of the, I don't know, I think most people don't understand how old the fleet is, maybe how long a ship is good for until it has to be replaced. Help the uninformed get a better idea of, is 293 all you need? Or how does replacement and those sorts of things come into play?
Sure. Well, it is a fact that things that humans build don't generally last forever. And that's certainly true of ships and aircraft that operate in the complex, demanding, and very, very difficult environment of the sea, of the oceans of the world, and the littoral areas, that is, the parts of the ocean that are close to land. Typically, we like to keep a ship for 30 to 40 years. We have an average age on our fleet today of about 24 years, and that includes submarines, the aircraft carriers, and the destroyers, cruisers, and littoral combat ships. Some of them quite new, but you can tell from that average age of in the mid-20s or so that it is a big challenge. We are constantly building new ships, bringing them out, putting them into commission, and operating them in order to carry out these missions that are assigned to us. You mentioned, or you asked, if 293 was the right number. Well, the day I entered the Naval Academy in the 1960s, we had almost 1,000 ships in the Navy, in the fleet. Now, a lot of them were frankly speaking, relics from World War II. Others were relatively new ships. They had different kinds of missions, and they were nowhere near as capable as the ships we have today. So when we talk about the right size of the ship and how one would compare that with any other ship around the world, it is by consensus in the people who analyze naval forces that the number one, the top, the most powerful fleet in the world today is the United States Navy. There's very little question about that. The Chinese fleet has more holes in the water, but in terms of capability, in terms of missions, in terms of modernization, in terms of the things that really matter in the measure of a ship, we are at the top of the heap. That doesn't give us a heck of a lot of margin, however, and when we talk about potential operations that the Navy might be involved with in the future, we only have to consider the kinds of operations the Navy's involved in today around the world. We look at in the Red Sea, for example, USS Eisenhower, an aircraft carrier strike group, is every day taking out anti-ship missiles that are endangering the sea lanes, endangering merchant ships plying their normal peacetime, innocent travel around the world to provide products and services to the world, the countries of the world. We look at threats to Taiwan and the South China Sea. We look at issues having to do with the Korean Peninsula and concerns there. We look at areas of the globe. Believe it or not, there is still a piracy issue around the world, whether it's in South Asia area, or in the the Western Pacific, or it's off the coast of Africa, or either in the South Atlantic or in the Indian Ocean. It's a genuine mission that continues. And one of the challenges, one of the concerns we have is, even with the exquisitely equipped, crewed, trained, and ready ships that we have in that battle force, a ship can only be in one place at one time. And when there are lots of different challenges around the world, whether it has to do with Eastern Europe, the Black Sea, the Mediterranean, the Pacific, you name it, it is a real challenge satisfying those operational demands of our combatant commanders to provide the fleet forces that are necessary for them to carry out their missions. And I am very sure that if you were to talk with any of those combatant commanders, they would tell you, yes, we can do our mission today, but it's a narrow margin. And I sure wish I had more forces at hand, ships, aircraft, and this pertains to the other military services as well.
Yeah, and what's unique, though, on the Navy mission, though, is you mentioned it, you can only have that ship in one spot, and it takes a long time to transit somewhere else. It's not a matter about jumping on a plane and moving folks by air travel. It's a much slower process, and it's not just the number of ships you have, but the types and the locations where they can be deployed, because you just ran us around the whole world from the Mideast to the South China Sea and everywhere in between. How do you then, you know, how is the country now planning, because a ship has such a long life and a long time to be, you know, it takes to build. How do you plan for the future like that? The ship you launch today is going to be around for 35 years. How do you think about what it's actually going to be used for over that 35-year period?
Well, that's a great question, Jim, and it's the center of why the National Defense Strategy is so important. The National Defense Strategy anticipates developments around the world that would make a big difference in the planning for structure, meaning how many people do we need to have on active duty? How many aircraft, how many ships, how much ammunition, how many systems? How do we tie all of those things together electronically in the sense of sharing information and intelligence and all of that? Keeping in mind that while we're doing our planning, our potential adversaries are doing the same. They are designing and building their forces, naval forces, military, air forces, space, and certainly cyber forces, to overcome the strengths that we have today. And our national military strategy leans forward on that. What do we have to be able to do to maintain our current advantages and avoid a situation where we're outgunned, we're outnumbered, and we've run out of ideas? We have got to create the warfighting advantages, and that will dictate what we need to build and what we need to invest in. And while we're doing that, one of the issues that is a controlling factor is the defense industrial sector. What can our private sector companies, our industry partners, and academia do to help us move forward? And I have to tell you that when we look at a battle force of 293 ships, not all of those ships are available all the time. They're going through maintenance. Nuclear-propelled ships go through periodic nuclear refueling, which takes a long time to get completed. It's expensive as well. The capacity of shipyards, both federal shipyards, and there are a few of those left, but commercial shipyards where the ships are built, where the ships are maintained, and the other industrial firms that provide maintenance and provide the systems, the armaments, the munitions, and the other systems that they need. It's a big challenge. So the question at this point comes, well, what are we going to do about all this? Looking at what the military leadership and what the senior folks in Congress and what the administration are dealing with, number one thing for them to keep in mind, and they do, is that the threats to our nation and our interests around the world are real and they're growing. It's a changing strategic environment. We've got to be able to defend the homeland. We've got to be able to deter strategic attack. And we've got to be able to deter potential adversaries from moving against us and be prepared to prevail in the event of a strategic attack or in the event of any conflict with any of the host of potential adversaries that are out there.
Well, you said one of the four pillars here of the mission is strategic deterrence, and you can't have strategic deterrence if your adversaries say, well, their fleet continues to erode and get older and they're not replacing it fast enough. We just have to wait them out 10 years and we'll have the advantage because there isn't strategic deterrence. So I recently was reading in preparation to talking to you the Congressional Research Service's white paper on March 1st, 2024 on the Navy force structure and shipbuilding plans, and they say, well, we're going to build 11 ships per year for 35 years, and that'll get us up to something like 355 ships. And my first reaction was, oh, my God, 35 years to get up to that number? Again, I have just a general layman's view of this thing. When you look at those kind of projections, and again, we're talking to retired Vice Admiral Kevin Green, who was the Deputy Chief Naval Operations Plans and Policy Director at one point, how do you look at those sort of plans and say, well, here's a 35-year plan, we'll try to build 11 a year?
Well, I'll tell you, Jim, it worries me, and I'm not alone. And we have put ourselves in a situation where in the short term, we have to focus on readiness. Readiness of the force, the platforms, that is the ships, aircraft, and other systems that we use, but ensuring that when they deploy, when they leave port to go over and carry out an operational mission, they are ready. They are trained. They are well-armed. The systems work. They have the spares and the materials and the ammo that they need to get the job done. That doesn't solve the longer-term problem, but it solves the immediate problem when we're able to get enough of them out there. There's been a lot of focus in the past several years on how many of this battle force, how many of the battle force ships are fully ready for mission. In the aviation world, they refer to that measure as full mission capable. And the FMC rates, full mission capability rates of the Naval Air Force has gone up significantly in the last several years due to investments and better means of managing that force. They've done a great job, and they have to stay on it. One of the things that occurs to me is this relationship with the Defense Industrial Base. And expanding that the defense industrial base and finding things like disruptive capabilities, the things that we haven't had in the past, things that make a difference. The Secretary of the Navy has put together a new disruptive capabilities office that is looking at just that. And they're principally looking at things like cyber warfare and use of drones and all that. I have observed, I have seen and been present at demonstrations from a lot of different companies that are not traditional defense firms that are applying new technologies to things that sound awfully mundane, things like propulsion systems. I saw a demo recently of a new kind of propulsion system for assault craft, amphibious craft, and so forth, that is so different from what's been used before. And finding a way of connecting the the government, the Department of Defense, and the folks who do the acquisition of new systems to connect them with the companies. I mean, this is good old American know-how and inventiveness and energy, and brilliant new thoughts, and being able to connect all of this together.
You really have to count on some of that to stay up with folks, countries who may be spending more money and attempting to leapfrog you in just numbers of ships at sea. You have to try to move forward with some technologies, this disruptive capabilities you mentioned. And that's one of the ones I wanted you to expand on a little bit, because the Navy's planning on actually quite a number of larger unmanned underwater vehicles for a variety of work and missions over the next couple of decades, and maybe moving that number up to, like, I think I read 150. Again, help us who aren't in this regularly to think about, what does that do? How does that help your capabilities?
Well, first of all, back to that earlier point that one ship can only be in one place at a time. The Fifth Fleet in the Persian Gulf and the Northern Indian Ocean and the Red Sea has for years now been engaged in a brilliantly successful and extremely innovative program to use unmanned systems, platforms, principally surface-based boats, if you will, aircraft also, to be able to expand their ability to conduct surveillance and intelligence gathering. That's been true in the Fourth Fleet area of responsibility as well, in the Caribbean and around South America and Central America. They're able to use these systems in a theater where it's hard to get a large number of ships and aircraft, because it's a very large area and there's lots of work to be done. But being able to use those kinds of systems is extraordinarily powerful. Admiral Paparo, who's the commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet now and has been confirmed by the Senate to be the next commander of the Indo-Pacific Command later this year, has made a number of public statements concerning the use of thousands of such unmanned systems, subsurface, surface, and aerial, to be able to, again, expand his ability to gain intelligence, conduct surveillance, and in some cases they can have other kinetic missions as well. It's a very exciting change, and it requires fewer people to be placed at the scene of action, if you will, some of these platforms have extraordinary endurance. They can go out for periods of time. We've done a number of fleet exercises in the last year and a half or so that have demonstrated the value to the fighting force of what these platforms can do.
Well, it's really interesting, and I think in a very positive way for national security, Admiral. And while I also am very worried that we don't either have the congressional budget for or the defense industrial base to build more ships at a more rapid pace than we need, I don't want to end this on a downer. I really want to come back and say, one of the things that I think is also going on in recognition of what some of our adversaries are doing is a greater effort to have naval partners, and I'm thinking of Australia in particular, but I suspect this goes on worldwide, that the U.S. Navy is working hard to have naval partners in other countries sort of as a force multiplier and a strategic deterrent. Can you advise us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And, you know, you and I were speaking last week about things. I mentioned that I served on a German ship back in my midshipman days. Ships that I served on as a commissioned officer had exchange officers and others, and we operated with NATO ships and with Japanese ships and with Korean ships and others as well. Today, the British, the French, the Germans, members of NATO, You know, countries in Europe are already engaged in planning and continuing a series of operations of their ships in the Western Pacific because of their understanding that if there's a serious problem somewhere in the globe, it's going to affect the entire globe. And that's a very, very encouraging and positive development. And I have to say that, once again, the strength of our national abilities is not dependent on us alone. We have great partners who've been proven in combat, who have made it very clear where their loyalties lie, and we couldn't be more fortunate than to have the friends that we do. And typically, the adversaries that we consider for potential concern in the future don't have that luxury of having strong, capable friends to be able to help them out.
When you get a chance and you bump into your local congressman or senator, you ought to ask them, what are they doing about, how much support are they giving to the Air Force and the Navy so that we have the machinery to defend the country when it comes time? Well, you're not going to hear these stories anywhere but on Veterans Radio. I hope you'll stay in contact with us through our webpage at veteransradio.org or on Facebook. I'm Jim Fossone, Dale Thronberry. We'll be back next week to talk about some of these issues, and we certainly appreciate all of our partners like NVBDC those Ann Arbor-based veteran service organizations, which have been helping us out for a long time, and my fellow board members who are always working to bring you the best we can in Veterans Radio. And until next time on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.